Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Relevant and engaging content designed to help you dominate the day.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Behind the Knife Clinical Challenge Series. We are the Miami Trauma Team, back with another episode from Jackson Memorial Hospital's Ryder Trauma Center. While I'm sure most of you have heard of the three rules of surgical training, eat when you can, sleep when you can, and don't mess with the pancreas. Well, today we're going to talk about what happens when you have to break that third rule. As always, we'd like to start with some introductions. I'm Mike Cobbler-Lichter, EGY3 in general surgery, and my first of 2 years of dedicated research with our trauma faculty here in Miami.
I'm Eugenia Kwan, trauma and surgical critical care fellow at the Ryder Trauma Center.
And my name is Jonathan Maysoso. I'm an attending trauma surgeon at the Ryder Trauma Center and an assistant professor of surgery at the University of Miami.
Today, as Mike mentioned, we're going to be talking about something that can strike fear into a lot of surgeons and surgical trainees. We're going to be discussing the management of traumatic pancreatic injuries using the Western Trauma Association's clinical decision algorithm as a guide, which will be included in the show notes. There's a lot to talk about here, so why don't we get right into it? Before we get into our cases, though, maybe we should do a quick review of the AAST grading of pancreatic trauma.
Yeah, that's a great idea. So like all of the AAST solid organ grading scales, we go from grade 1 to grade 5, with grade 1 being the least severe and grade 5 being the most severe. For me, it's easiest to remember what the most extreme grades are first and then work back from there. So a grade 1 injury is either a contusion or a superficial laceration without ductal involvement, and then a grade 5 injury is massive disruption of the pancreatic head. Then, if I remember, grade 1 is a contusion or superficial laceration without duct injury, it's easy for me to remember that a grade 2 injury is slightly more severe than this, now either involving multiple locations or laceration with disruption of less than 50% of the pancreatic parenchyma. It's also important to remember that grade 1 and 2 injuries do not involve the duct, whereas grade 3 and 4 injuries both involve ductal disruption. The only difference between grade 3 and 4 is where the ductal injury occurs. Again, if we think about these grades as going from less severe to more severe, grade 3 means there's a distal ductal injury because that's generally easier to manage, and a grade 4 means there's a proximal duct injury since those are more difficult to manage.
That's a great review. Now let's get into our cases. So your first case is a 35-year-old female involved in a head-on motor vehicle collision. You do your primary survey as always, which is intact. The patient is hemodynamically stable, but on secondary survey, you notice the patient's complaining of epigastric and back pain and has a prominent abdominal seatbelt sign. What kinds of injuries jump to the front of your mind with this presentation?
Well, anytime I see a seatbelt sign across the belly, I think about anything that could be compressed between that seatbelt and the spine, and even the spine itself. So obviously that includes the viscera between the spine and the abdominal wall, which depends on the location and fit of the seatbelt, but it's usually small bowel as well as the pancreas.
Great. And the point about location and fit of the seatbelt is important. Depending on where you see the seatbelt sign, whether it's across the abdomen, the chest, or the neck, you may have a higher index of suspicion for certain injury patterns. But this episode is about the pancreas. So we have our hemodynamically stable patient with a seatbelt sign, abdominal pain, and back pain. What's next?
I think at most places, the presence of a seatbelt sign is a pretty convincing clinical finding to head on over to the Truth Machine and get that trauma scan. But that's not the only way to diagnose a pancreas injury. How else might you diagnose a pancreatic injury, Mike?
Well, in the trauma setting, you're probably either going to diagnose it most of the time on CT scan or on laparotomy in the case of an unstable patient. If for some reason the patient doesn't get scanned and does get admitted, any kind of worsening abdominal pain, leukocytosis, unexplained metabolic acidosis, fever, or elevation in amylase or lipase may be signs of an occult or a missed injury as well. But obviously none of these are terribly sensitive. But they do all hit at some underlying process going on in the abdomen, whether it's a missed helleviscus injury or an injury to the pancreas.
Good. Now, what can we expect to see on CT that suggests a pancreatic injury?
This obviously will depend on the grade of injury, as it's much easier to see a massive disruption of the pancreatic head than it is a minor laceration at the tail. But in general, for these lower grade injuries, you may see the laceration or contusion itself if it's large enough. Or you may see edema, hematoma of the parenchyma, or more nonspecific signs such as fat stranding or peripancreatic blood. Similar to a small bowel injury, these findings may be subtle if imaged very close to the time of injury.
Are there any other associated injuries you can see on a CT scan that make you more concerned for a pancreatic injury?
I think I remember this from back in med school. So if you see a chance fracture of the spine, you should have a higher index of suspicion of a pancreatic injury.
And what exactly is a chance fracture, Eugenia?
So this is essentially when the seatbelt acts as a fulcrum and the point of motion is the spine itself. So think about the spinal column bending around the fixed seatbelt. This leads to a horizontal fracture where the anterior and middle columns are put into compression and the posterior column is put into extension.
Okay, great. So let's get back to our patient. She comes back from CT. Let's say she has a 1 centimeter distal laceration to the pancreas. What should your next question be?
I want to know if it involves a duct.
Exactly. Ductal involvement is what pushes you from that low grade, grade 1 or 2 injury, into the higher grade, grade 3 and above injury territory. So what if you can't rule out a distal duct injury based on the CT scan? Does she need an operation?
Maybe, but I would probably want to get an MRCP before deciding, assuming they're stable. While new multi-detector CTs have a pretty high sensitivity, we really don't want to miss a high-grade injury with a duct disruption. Dr. Mizoso, what are your thoughts on when to pursue MRCP for these distal injuries with questionable duct involvement in a stable patient? I know they're often difficult to get done quickly, especially in the middle of the night.
That's a great question. In general, CT is still not a great modality for diagnosing pancreas injuries, which we've already mentioned, and particularly for identifying an injury to the pancreatic duct, especially if you image the patients early after injury. Even with a 64-slice CT, the sensitivity for detecting a pancreatic injury greater than 50% of the parenchyma is only about 50%, so about a flip of a coin. So you can imagine if we're talking about greater than 50% laceration of the parenchyma, the sensitivity for a ductal injury is much lower. That being said, I think my practice is to get an MRCP if I'm suspicious enough that there may be a ductal injury and the CT findings cannot definitively rule it out. So back to our case, let's say we get an MRCP and there's no evidence of a ductal injury. Do we still think she needs to go to the operating room?
At this point, with a low-grade injury not involving the duct, our first line would be expectant non-operative management.
Great. Let's say we do that. How long would you typically observe her for?
If the patient remains stable, her pain's controlled, she's ambulating and tolerating PO, I think a period of a few days is reasonable, assuming there are no other injuries. But these are often high energy mechanisms, and patients often do have other injuries that will keep them in the hospital anyway.
Okay, good. Yeah, I think that's a good summary. In general, you know, if they only have an isolated injury, they may be in the hospital 3 or 4 days. But most of these patients are a little bit on the sicker side and multiply injured, so they'll be in the hospital for a while. What do we need to be on the lookout for in the post-injury period if this patient doesn't get discharged because of other injuries or when they see us back in the clinic? What do we have to be looking out for?
Even those low-grade injuries have a risk of persistent pancreatic fistula or pseudocyst formation, which may need to be treated with drainage, ERCP, stenting, or cystoenterostomy, but that type of chronic management is a bit outside the scope of this episode.
Great. Mike, what if this patient had their injury discovered at the time of laparotomy and not on a CT scan?
Well, if it still looks like a low-grade injury, the vast majority can be treated with hemostasis and wide drainage. In fact, many low-grade injuries can drain for several days, so the recommendation is really to use drainage liberally.
Why not just repair it if you're already there?
Well, most of these injuries are self-limited. The minor fistulae will close on their own, and the drainage is easily managed with a drain or two. We don't want to risk any of the possible complications of pancreas surgery, such as pseudocyst formation, that could land our patient in the hospital for months. And these patients are often, you know, not your chronically sick patients who get your Whipple out of that hard pancreas. These are, you know, soft pancreas, difficult to sew to.
Great. Now let's change it up a bit. What if the MRCP had come back positive and you had seen a distal pancreatic transection? What now, Eugenia? OR?
So that's one option. And in smaller centers or on your boards, that is probably the best option for distal main duct grade 3 injury. However, depending on your local resource availability, endoscopic management with ERCP and transpapillary pancreatic duct stenting may be an option. It is worth mentioning that there is some evidence to suggest lower rates of complication after operative compared to endoscopic management, specifically in regards to main duct strictures. But as with the entirety of this algorithm, there is a paucity of class 1 data involving RCTs in this topic.
That's exactly right. I would say that in general, you need to be at a high volume center with significant experience in managing these types of injuries with ERCP for pancreatic duct stenting to even consider doing some kind of a non-operative management. I would say I'm a surgeon. I like to operate. This is an operative injury if you have a distal ductal injury. So in the absence of, significant experience with an ERCP or, surgeon judgment that operation is the way to go, I think it's probably safer to manage these patients operatively. So let's say for whatever reason you can't get the ERCP, what's your plan, Mike?
So in this patient with a grade 3 pancreatic injury, I would plan on going to the OR for an exploratory laparotomy.
Okay, good. That's probably what I would do too. Eugenia, what would you plan on doing in the case?
So we said this is a distal injury. The location of the injury matters a lot when treating pancreatic injuries. In this case, I would plan on doing a distal pancreatectomy with or without splenectomy.
Okay. We keep talking about distal or proximal. What determines if the injury is distal or proximal for a pancreatic duct injury? What's the cutoff?
So the SMV is a common landmark to denote a left-sided pancreatic injury from a right-sided pancreatic injury.
That's exactly right. So, Mike, why is it important to make this distinction?
So, as we mentioned before, the management changes. I'm sure a lot of our listeners have heard the crawfish analogy, but for any of you who haven't, pancreatic injury treatment is a lot like eating a crawfish. You suck the head and eat the tail. So things that are to the left of the SMV, we tend to resect, and things to the right of the SMV, we tend to drain widely.
That's exactly right. And you mentioned that the distal pancreatectomy can be done with or without a splenectomy. What would make you decide one way or the other?
So there's a couple things to consider here. As we mentioned, these are often high energy mechanisms with other concomitant injuries. If we're in the OR for hemodynamic instability, if the patient's sick, if there's a clear spleen injury, the spleen is going into the bucket.
But if the patient is hemodynamically normal, has few or minor other injuries, or is younger, especially kids, we can try and make more of an effort to preserve the spleen while doing our distal pancreatectomy.
Those are all great points, Eugenia. However, I will say that the vast majority of these injuries end up getting both the distal pancreatectomy and the splenectomy. Splenic preservation should definitely be a consideration whenever you're doing this, especially when you're doing it in a delayed fashion. But oftentimes, it's going to prove to be more difficult than it looks in the textbooks. This is particularly true in adults. There's usually a lot more visceral fat that obscures the pancreatic vessel branches to the splenic vessels. In children, I think due to the immunologic advantages of keeping the spleen, splenic preservation is more common and more doable, again, because of their anatomy. But kind of overall, I think distal pancreatectomy with splenectomy is generally the operation that's done. Definitely, if you're in your first operation and the trauma has kind of done the majority of the operation already and has, essentially done the distal pancreatectomy, you generally just want to finish it off and do the splenectomy at the same time because those patients may not be super stable. So back to our patient, she had a grade 3 pancreas injury that was treated with a distal pancreatectomy and splenectomy. She recovers well, starts to tolerate oral intake, but on the first day after starting oral intake, we notice her drain output increases and changes color. What do we need to be on the lookout for in the post-op period in this patient, Mike?
So this is definitely concerning for a postoperative pancreatic fistula.
And how would you confirm your diagnosis?
Well, with this increased drain output, I would start by sending a drain amylase. If this was higher than 3 times the upper limit of normal in the serum, that would be indicative of a post-op pancreatic fistula.
This is true, but with one important caveat. To be strictly defined as a postoperative pancreatic fistula, the condition needs to be clinically relevant. What we used to call a grade A pancreatic fistula is now no longer actually considered a true pancreatic fistula or even an actual complication as described by the International Study Group of Pancreatic Fistulas 2016 update. If the patient remains clinically well and there's no true clinical impact, this is considered to be with normal post-operative pathway and is described now as a biochemical fistula.
Okay, so what do we consider a true post-operative pancreatic fistula?
So that's basically a pancreatic leak in association with a clinically relevant condition. So this would be a grade B fistula, and anything that leads to organ failure, clinical instability, or the need to go back to the OR would be considered a grade C fistula. And the severity of the fistula determines the treatment, and treatment can be from supplementing with short, medium chain fatty acids and making an MPO to medical therapy with somatostatin, and all the way up until percutaneous, endoscopic, or even surgical drainage as necessary. Though this is getting a little bit outside of the scope of this episode.
Great, I agree. Let's go back and why don't we change the scenario again? Let's say we still have a ductal injury, but this time it was to the right of the SMV. Does this change management?
Yeah, it definitely does. So remember our crawfish metaphor. In this case, we have a grade 4 injury, and so it's recommended to drain widely.
All right, that's excellent. I agree. Most of the time, it's best to do the least amount possible in these cases. Draining and getting out of Dodge is usually the best technique. However, I think for completion, it's important to note that in some cases, that's not possible or reasonable. And at least according to the textbook, there are some options to consider for a grade 4 injury other than wide drainage. So I'm just going to talk about that for like a couple seconds. So for example, depending on the injury, a subtotal pancreatectomy of 70 to 90% of the pancreas with a splenectomy may be indicated, and other injuries may even require that trauma Whipple that we all talk about. But again, I think in most cases, simple drainage, wide drainage will suffice. That's what I usually do and what's recommended in the Western trauma algorithm. Now let's say another patient comes in with a similar mechanism, but in the trauma bay, he's hypotensive and has a positive FAS. You take him to the OR for a laparotomy. What are some intraoperative clues that you may be dealing with a pancreas injury?
Yeah, it's really critical to thoroughly explore both the pancreas and duodenum if there's concern for injury to this area. Things that may clue you into this are retroperitoneal hematoma, bile staining, fat necrosis, or edema in the supramesocolic region. If you have any of these or even a suspicious high energy mechanism with associated injuries like a chance fracture, you really should be dividing the gastrocolic ligament to get into lesser sac. This will let you inspect the pancreatic body and tail. As an aside though, like always, it's really important to approach trauma in a systematic fashion the same way every time. We mentioned this patient has a positive FAST. I just wanted to point out that you won't see a positive FAST with retroperitoneal injuries, so it's important to identify all injuries. Don't get tunnel vision on the pancreas just because this is the pancreas episode.
Those are great points. Got to remember the ABCs. Speak of the pancreas, though, will you be able to access the entirety of the pancreas from the retrogastric approach by opening the gastrocolic ligament?
No, definitely not. If there's concern for pancreatic head or duodenal injury, we should be cocarizing the patient in order to get better access to the duodenal sleep, as well as the head and unsynced process of the pancreas.
Good. Again, because this is the pancreas episode, there's a lot of talk about, you know, if there's concern for pancreatic injury to X location. But most of the time, you don't really know this at the time of a trauma laparotomy that you're doing for hemorrhage control. So yeah, I think the safest technique and one that gives you as trainees practice for when it's like really go time and you really do have an injury is to get into the habit of routinely opening the lesser sac, performing a Coker maneuver to fully assess the retroperitoneum. I think that's really best practice for a true exploratory laparotomy, right? That's part of the name of the operation, is an exploratory laparotomy. And if you're doing that, then I think you should do, you know, all of the maneuvers to really ensure that you don't have an injury in an area that you suspect you have an injury. So let's say you do that and you find a clear grade 5 injury where the pancreatic head is just blown apart. Eugenia, is this the time for the trauma Whipple?
Fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you look at it, no, it's not. A grade 5 injury should really be treated like a damage control operation. control bleeding, control sepsis with wide drainage, and live to fight another day.
Something I was wondering is, what if your patient had been hemodynamically stable and you're discovering this injury in the OR? Is there ever a role for a primary trauma Whipple, or should we basically always be planning on coming back later?
In general, I would say the safest thing is to come back. These patients are not in good shape in the OR, usually. If you have a grade 5 pancreatic injury, that usually comes with a duodenal injury, maybe a liver injury, or another hollow viscous injury. Don't poke the bear. We don't like leaving abdomens open these days and have really decreased the number of open abdomens significantly, even since I started my training. But this is one time where it's very appropriate to do so. So again, don't poke the bear. Do the least possible in the first case.
Any other things to consider with these challenging cases that we haven't talked about?
Well, one thing to consider is that the vast majority of these grade 5 injuries are going to have associated duodenal trauma, as I mentioned. So you're going to have to know how to manage this as well. And maybe that's another future episode for BTK. One very important thing, though, is to think about feeding access for these high-grade injury patients, especially those with combined duodenal trauma. And that's preferably in the form of a feeding jejunostomy, but you can also do that with a nasojejunal tube. Additionally, patients may benefit from elemental formulas with lower fat and higher pH to minimize the amount of pancreatic stimulation. I think it's also important, you know, in the future, once these patients recover from their initial insult, to talk to your patients and let them know how the operation that you did will affect them in the future. For example, particularly if you had to do an extended distal pancreatectomy where you're removing a significant proportion of their exocrine and their islet cell function, patients need to know that things like alcoholism and obesity will affect their recovery and that they may become diabetic and are going to need to check their glucoses to make sure that they're not progressing into diabetes, depending on the residual endocrine function that they have left.
Okay, great. So to summarize, pancreas injuries and the associated grade are most often diagnosed on either CT or laparotomy. To rule out ductal injury, patients may benefit from MRCP if there are equivocal CT findings, which are notoriously not as accurate as we would like with pancreas injuries. Low-grade injuries without ductal involvement, so grade 1 or 2, can generally be managed non-operatively. But higher grade injuries with ductal involvement require intervention of some kind, either ERCP or laparotomy. But most of the time, in most settings, this should probably be laparotomy. Our procedure of choice once in the belly depends on location and grade of injury. Low grade injuries, again, grade 1 or 2, with low risk of ductal involvement, can be treated with closed suction drainage. When we start getting into grade 3 and 4, the location matters a whole lot more. Here's where you remember the crawfish: suck the head and eat the tail. If it's to the right of the SMV, closed suction drainage is your best option. But if it's to the left, distal pancreatectomy, usually with splenectomy, is your best option. And finally, if we're dealing with a destructive injury to the pancreatic head, we're really talking about a damage control situation. Control bleeding, control sepsis, live to fight another day. Drain widely, stabilize the patient, and come back later for your reconstruction. There are really very few indications for a trauma Whipple off the bat nowadays.
Yeah, that's right. And remember, the trauma Whipple is one of those scenarios where no single trauma surgeon has a very large series of experience. I can't stress enough how important it is to approach these injuries with help. Don't be the hero. Get advice from a senior partner. If that's another trauma surgeon who's managed a few of these, great. If it's someone outside your own division who routinely does pancreatic surgery, that's fine too. And if there's no one at your institution who can help, consider transferring the patient somewhere else for definitive management after you've done the damage control. And the good thing is that with good drainage, you can usually temporize most of these injuries. If you're getting help from a non-trauma surgeon, though, remember, they're used to doing elective surgery. So it's your job as the trauma surgeon to understand the physiology of the patient and to stop them from doing more than is necessary in the acute setting and make sure to advocate for doing, you know, the least possible that the patient will tolerate to address the injury and come back for a more complicated reconstruction when they've really been optimized as much as possible.
All right. Great work, everyone. Hopefully people are feeling a little less scared of the pancreas after that review. I think it's time to summarize these points with a few quick hits. Number one, Pancreas injuries do not all require a trip to the operating room. Low-grade injuries should be managed with a trial of non-operative management if there are no other operative indications. Number two, CT is the best initial imaging modality, although it has low sensitivity. If there's high concern for pancreas injury based on mechanism or associated injuries, further investigation is required. Number three, pancreas injuries are like crawfish. Suck the head and eat the tail.
Number four, injuries to the left of the SMB can generally be treated with distal pancreatectomy and splenectomy, whereas injuries to the right of the SMB are usually drained. Number five, it's important to identify and address any concomitant injuries, with duodenal injuries being the most common and high-grade injury. Number six, in the case of the dreaded grade five injury, the safe answer is to come back and do your reconstruction at a later time.
Okay, thanks for listening, everyone. And until next time, dominate the day.
Be sure to check out our website at www.behindtheknife.org for more great content. You can also follow us on Twitter at Behind the Knife and Instagram at Behind the Knife Podcast. If you like what you hear, please take a minute to leave us a review. Content produced by Behind the Knife is intended for health professionals and is for educational purposes only. We do not diagnose, treat, or offer patient-specific advice. Thank you for listening.
Until next time, dominate the day.